Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You remember that we discussed last week that a group of people, 12 men from Medina, on the occasion of Hajj, on the 12th year of Hijra, of Bi'tha, they came to Mina and they paid allegiance to Prophet with a bay'ah which did not include protection. And that's why it was called Bay'atun Nisa. It means that they followed the Prophet fully, however, they did not have any responsibility or did not give any pledge to protect the Prophet with their lives. Now, after this Bay'ah was completed, when people went back to Medina, Prophet, as I said last week, sent Mus'ab ibn Umayr with them to teach them Qur'an. Now, this Mus'ab was a very energetic and active man. A young man with lots of energy. So, he used to go everywhere in Medina and talk about Islam. And since, of course, many of those people around him were very well-known people for people of Medina, so they didn't actually bother or they didn't want to be bothered by somehow insulting Mus'ab or something like that. Now, one very important instance was when Abu Umama, that As'ad ibn Zurara, said that if one person you can convert in Medina, then you can have the Medina. And this is Sa'd ibn Mu'adh. Sa'd ibn Mu'adh was the head of Bani Amr ibn Auf, as it's written here, Bani Amr ibn Auf, the Islam of Bani Amr ibn Auf. He said, if you can convert Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, you will win the Medina. And he is my uncle, actually. His tribe is my relatives, so I can take you there. You start speaking for them and see if you can convert this Sa'd ibn Mu'adh. Well, you have heard of Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, of course, later on when Prophet sent him to Yemen. A very important and one of the most significant basis of Sunni jurisprudence is based on what Prophet told Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, said to Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, that when I send you to Yemen, on what basis will you judge among the people? And he said, I'll judge according to the Qur'an. Then the Prophet said, if you don't find anything in the Qur'an, he said, I will judge according to what I have heard from you or from your Sunnah. And then Prophet asked him, if you do not find anything in my Sunnah, he said, I judge according to my own understanding and reason. And this has become a basis for Sunni jurisprudence for using Qiyas. They say Sa'd ibn Mu'adh here meant that he would use Qiyas or analogy in finding out the rules of Sharia. So, of course, an important person, that's why Prophet sent him to Yemen at that early stages of his migration to Medina. Now, when Mus'ab ibn Umayr went to this area of Bani Amr ibn Auf, he started to speak to the youngsters about Islam, to recite the Quran, and he did it for a couple of days. The youngsters came, they started to listen, they were very interested, and Sa'd heard about it. Of course, Sa'd was the head of that sub-tribe. So Sa'd heard about it and sent someone called Usayd ibn Hudayr, whose name is mentioned here as well, Usayd ibn Hudayr. He sent him and said, go and tell to this young man. Either he would go and would not show up here anymore, or I will come and teach him a lesson. Now this Usayd came and he said, why are you taking our youngsters from us? You are teaching them ill practice and bad ideas. And this Abu Umama said, Usayd, come and listen to this man, young man. Just listen what he's saying. If you like it, then you might just decide not to do anything bad to this man. If you don't, then you will do whatever you want. Now Usayd came and Mus'ab started to recite some Qur'an for him. Hameen, Tanzeelun min ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Kitabun fussilat ayatuhu. Of course, as I said, these verses had great impact even in the tone, in the rhythm, in literature, every aspect. Now they say, as soon as Usayd heard this surah, Hameen Fussila, he said, what should I do to become a Muslim? What should I do to convert to your religion? He said, well, you have to go and wash because you are a mushrik, you eat vile things, you have to wash, make a ghusl, put on clean clothes, and teach you how to pray. Now there was a well there. Usayd said, I don't want to go home, I don't want to waste time. He just jumped into the well, washed himself with all his clothes, and came out and said, okay, what should I say now? They said, okay, say, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And he said, and he became Muslim. Now, then he went and spoke to Sa'd ibn Mu'adh. He said, Sa'd, I have converted to their religion. You sent me there, but I have converted to the religion, and you have to come and listen to this man. And Sa'd said, okay. Sa'd also came, listened to Mus'ab, and he was fascinated as well. So Sa'd ibn Mu'adh also said, okay, I become a Muslim, and I make all Bani Amr ibn Auf a Muslim. Now, he gathered towards the evening of the same day, he gathered all his tribesmen and women, and he said, anyone who wants to have any relation and connection to me should convert to the religion of this man. Otherwise, I have no connection with him. And since he was very much respected, they all converted. So, in this way, actually, the Islam, during the 1 year period, from the year, Hajj of year 12, when this Bay'atul Aqaba was concluded between the Prophet and people of Medina, to the year 13 when they came to make another Bay'ah with the Prophet, Islam was actually the prevalent religion in Medina. It became something that in every house people were talking about Islam. And as this happened, as of course people of Medina started to accept Islam and to convert to Islam, Prophet saw this is a very good opportunity for those followers of him who were under torture, under pressure, to send them to Medina. So a gradual migration of people started towards Medina. But of course Prophet himself, he couldn't go to Medina because he didn't have anyone to protect him. Still, there was no pact of protection in Medina. But he sent gradually his followers. And of course, this somehow made people of Mecca sensitive. What's happening? Why Islam is spreading in Medina? This is dangerous. Of course, it was dangerous for them. What if Muhammad wants to go there? And what if they start to protect him? Then there's war. They would cut off our route to Syria. That was very dangerous. I mean, this is what actually virtually happened immediately after the migration of the Prophet. They threatened the route to Syria, and then that's why there was a war. So it made them very, very sensitive and wary about what was happening. So they started to prevent the Muslims to migrate to Medina. And it was even more dangerous for them than the migration to Habasha, to Ethiopia. Of course, Ethiopia was a very far away land. Muslims could just run away and go to Ethiopia, to Abyssinia. However, Medina was not a far away place. Medina was a strategic place for people of Mecca. It was not something that they just could let happen. And Muslims go there, establish themselves, and they invite the Prophet. So they started to put pressure on Muslims, not letting them to go to to go to Medina. Now there are some examples. I just mentioned a couple of examples, not more than that. Of course, the way they wanted to stop Muslims to migrate to Medina was very harsh. However, just a couple of examples. You have heard of Umm Salama, of course, the respected wife of the Prophet, but at this time she was not the wife of the Prophet. She was the wife of someone who was called Abu Salama, because their child was Salama. Of course, the father was called Abu Salama, she was called Umm Salama. And Abu Salama was martyred in the fourth year after Hijra, the third year after Hijra, and the Prophet married Umm Salama in the fourth year after Hijra. But now, of course, she was a Muslim convert who wanted to migrate to Medina with her husband. Now, what the Mushrikun did, they instigated the tribe of Umm Salama that you shouldn't let your girl to go to Medina. Of course, she was a young girl at that time, Umm Salama. You shouldn't let her go. And even Abu Salama wants to take her, you shouldn't allow that. So what they did, they came and stopped Abu Salama, Umm Salama, and their child on the way. And they said to Abu Salama, "We cannot stop you going to Medina, but we don't let our relative, our daughter, to come with you." Well, they insisted a lot, and they said, "It's impossible that we let Umm Salama to come to you." Abu Salama said, "Okay, you want to keep your daughter? I go." Abu Salama migrated to Medina. Umm Salama was left with her own tribe, who were from Bani Mughayra. Then, the tribe of Abu Salama, a very funny type of decision, they came to Bani Mughayra and they said, "Look, this child belongs to us, Salama, because we are the family of his father, he belongs to us, we have to take him." And they took Salama, and Umm Salama was left with her people, without the child, without a husband, and with lots of annoyance, rebukes, and all these things. And that's why they say that she herself says that when this happened to me for 1 year, every day I came out, sitting on the way, crying until evening. And everyone passing, knowing that, well, what has happened to me? My husband is in Medina. My child is with Bani Abdul Asad, and I'm left here being annoyed by my own people, bullied by my own people. Until one of her cousins went to Bani Abdul Asad and said, "Look what you are doing to this poor lady. You have taken her child, her husband is not here, and she's a captive." And of course, after lots of negotiations, they let her go with her child. And a very beautiful instance is this. That shows, although the Mushrikun were people of ignorance, but they had qualities. You remember we talked about Murawwa, the manliness, the type of character which showed magnanimity and honor. They had this. And this is why, of course, many of them accepted Islam. Now, she wanted to go to Medina. The poor lady, she had a camel and her child. And she set on the way, and she didn't know where is Medina. Just like Musa when he came out of Egypt, he didn't know where is Madian. He just said, "Asa an yahdiyani rabbi sawa ila sawa as-sabil." I hope God just guides me, because I don't know where Madian is. Now, she came out, someone called Uthman ibn Talha, which probably later converted to Islam, but he was a mushrik. He saw her on the way. He said, "Where are you going, daughter of Umayyah?" Her father's name was Umayyah. She said, "I'm going to Medina." He said, "Without guide, without company?" She said, "Yes, I don't have anyone. I just rely on God." He said, "It's impossible that you can find your way. I will take you." And this man, Umm Salama, says, "I never saw any man more honorable than this man." She explains later on that how did he accompany her to Medina. She says that whenever, of course, he was taking the reins of my camel, going on foot, and whenever we wanted to rest, he made my camel to sit. I came down. He went to a far place, rested there. I rested here. And then afterwards, he came, he told me this is the time to go. And he did the same thing until we reached Quba. And in the Quba, he said, "Your husband is in this city, go." And he just went back to Medina. Now, you might went back to Mecca. You might be surprised at why such a man should do. I mean, it's not a car or an airplane to take someone to Medina and go back in a few hours. It was 2 weeks, well, more than that probably, going on foot to Medina and coming back. But why such a man, a mushrik, should do such a thing to a woman who wants to migrate to Medina? Is there any thought about this? No, he didn't. He didn't have any relation. He just knew, of course, who this girl was. That, of course, he was from a noble family. She was from a noble family. And he took upon himself that this is something that I have to do. Now, the reason is, and Quran stresses this, you see, sometimes you see Quran invokes some qualities which were very well known in Arab, especially in the Arab of that area. Ma'ruf. Ma'ruf, something which is honorable. And Quran always invokes this concept. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُ بِالْعَدْلِ وَالْإِحْسَانِ, which is, both of which are ma'ruf. يَأْمُرُهُمْ, and in one verse, Allah says, "What? Why do you not believe in this prophet? Because what he is doing is what you want to be done. يَأْمُرُهُمْ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَيَنْهَاهُمْ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. He orders you to ma'ruf, he prohibits you from munkar. So these were the characters, and that's why some of these Arabs, as soon as they heard the message, like Sa'd ibn Mu'adh, like Usayd ibn Hudayr, they just believed. They didn't wait for any other reason or argument. They just saw this to be something which addressed the qualities which they valued as well. Now, you can imagine in the... Now, the other instance is the migration of Ayyash ibn Abi Rabi'ah. Sorry? Well, as I said, that's Murawwah, which was very widespread among the Arabs. Sorry? Sir, I didn't hear it. Okay, you don't want to repeat that. No problem. Well, I mean, we can analyze that in many different ways. And in Arab custom, it was not very surprising that, for example, someone needed 100 camels to pay as blood money, otherwise they would have been killed. And someone else came and said, "I will take the responsibility and pay, I pay," without having even half a camel. Just saying, "I will do that, I will go and find and bring it for you." Or that, you remember that idea of protection. I mean, they protected a person, or for example, their guest. If someone was your guest, or their guest, and he was attacked, no matter who that person was, and who the others who attacked him were, this guest should have been protected until death. I mean, until the host would have died. And it's a very famous story. There's a story saying that once the grasshoppers, not grasshoppers, what do you call these? Locusts. Locusts. Someone had a guest in the desert, and the locusts attacked. And when they attack, of course, they sometimes attack even human beings. Now this man, he came out, took his sword and said to locusts, "You dare come near this man and want to annoy him. He is my guest." This is a famous story in Arab. They have made parables of this. So these were the qualities. And for example, you have heard about the story of Ibrahim. He saw three men coming as his guests. As he didn't ask who you are, he didn't ask why have you come here. He just فَمَا لَبِثَ أَنْ جَاءَ بِأَجْلٍ حَنِيذٍ. He just went and slaughtered a big calf and cooked it and brought it for them. And then afterwards he started to ask, okay, who are you? Why are you here? These were qualities which, of course, were probably a reason why Islam came in that area. Despite the ignorance, they had very good qualities as well. Anyhow, this Ayyash ibn Abi Rabi'ah, this poor man, he migrated to Medina. He reached Medina. But his relatives came after him and said, your mother is dying because of your migration. And she has pledged that she would not comb her hair, she would not sleep until you come back to her. And when he heard that, he said, okay, this is very bad. My mother would die if she goes like that. So he started to go back to Mecca with them. And in the middle of the way, they overpowered him. They started to beat him. They handcuffed him and brought him to Medina, beating him. And in a way, he was defeated. And of course, later on, he went back again. But they went out of their way to even bring back people who had migrated to Medina, to bring them back. Now, why they did this? Because they saw that in this course of 1 year, from 12 after Ba'sa to 13 after Ba'sa, Islam actually became the dominant religion in Medina. And this is before Prophet going to Medina. And then you can imagine what they would have they done if they knew that Prophet wanted to go to Medina. Of course, they would have done everything to prevent Prophet to migrate to Medina, as we will see later on. No, no. Of course, because Jews were minority. I mean, yes, among the Arabs who were living there, not the Jews, of course, because none of them believed in Islam before migration of the Prophet. Some of them afterwards, yes. Now, the second bay'ah was the most important bay'ah in the history of Islam, ever made in the history of Islam. Now, that was when, in the year 13, 75 people, 73 men and 2 women, they came for Hajj with many other people from Medina and nearby villages, and they had an arrangement with the Prophet to go and meet him in Mina, in Aqaba. Aqaba was a place. Why it happened in Aqaba? Because in that Aqaba, which was a type of valley, Abdul Muttalib had a house, and they actually met in that house of Abdul Muttalib. Now, in that house of Abdul Muttalib, they made a pledge with the Prophet that not only they accept what was agreed last year, that Bay'atul Nisa, that they protect the Prophet with their life. In a way, inviting the Prophet to go to Medina. The previous year, they did not invite the Prophet because it was very dangerous. Now, they invited the Prophet to go to Medina, and they gave the pledge to protect the Prophet with their life. And this was, of course, very, very risky. Because what they were doing, they were buying upon themselves the animosity of the whole Arab tribes and other areas in the peninsula. So that's why when they were making this pledge, someone who was there, Abbas ibn Ubadah, he told them that, are you aware what type of pledge you are giving to this man? It means that you are buying the animosity of the red and black. Well, this was something which they used to say. We say black and white people, they said red and black people. Because probably they haven't seen white people. Red and black. You buy upon yourself the animosity of red and black. And you will be attacked from every side. And if you invite this man to your city, and then stop protecting him, you become tired of it and you say, okay, now go, we cannot protect you anymore. Then, first of all, you have betrayed this man, and secondly, you have dishonored yourself. So, you have to think twice before you give this pledge to the Prophet. Now, all of them said, No, we give this pledge. And we want the Prophet to come to our city. So they made the pledge, which was called Bay'atul Harb, the pledge of war. The previous pledge was called Bay'atul Nisa, the pledge of the women's pledge. And this one was called Bay'atul Harb, that they gave the pledge that they would fight to protect the Prophet. Now, in Ibn Hisham and many other historians, they say this statement, which is I mentioned, was by Abbas ibn Ubadah, was a statement made by Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet. And many other instances, they say that in those instances, Abbas, the uncle of the Prophet, was with him, advising him, telling him what to do, telling other people. And this is very, very funny. Because the following year, Abbas goes to battle to fight against the Prophet. I mean, it is impossible to think like that. The only thing is that these books were written at the time of Banu Abbas, and they wanted Abbas to come into the limelight. And therefore, anywhere any name of Abbas was found, they said, this is Abbas, uncle of the Prophet. Right here. This Abbas ibn Ubadah, who was from Medina, he started to speak like that, and they said, this was Abbas, uncle of the Prophet, speaking like that. And this is why anywhere you see any trace of Abbas's influence or Abbas's protection or whatever in history, you really have to doubt that. Because Abbas did not believe in the Prophet. He stayed in Mecca until the very last, until the conquest of Mecca. He was captured in the Battle of Badr, and so on and so forth. Anyhow, after this pledge was made, the Prophet appointed 12 leaders, naqib, for to lead the affairs of Muslims in Medina. From among those 75 people, he chose 12 leaders. Well, big, of course, prominent people like Sa'd ibn Ubadah, like Usayd ibn Khudayr, and these people, they were chosen as Nuqaba. Now, there is always this question, why did Prophet choose 12 naqib, or 12 leaders, or 12 chiefs? While after going to Medina, they didn't have any role to play at all. What was the reason? Well, first of all, these 12 leaders were the leaders who could actually bring all the tribes under the banner of Islam. And they actually were the people who could teach good Islam to their own people. Now, we have the same thing with Banu Israel. In verse number 12 of Surah Ma'idah, Allah mentions the same thing, exactly the same thing about Banu Israel. وَلَقَدْ أَخَذَ اللَّهُ مِثَاقَ بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ وَبَعَثْنَا مِنْهُمْ أُثْنَيْ عَشَرَ نَقِيبًا. Certainly Allah took a pledge from the children of Israel, just like the Prophet took a pledge from people of Medina, and we raised up among them 12 chiefs. Now, what was the role of these 12 chiefs? Were they, like for example, governors or something like that? Of course not. What the verse says is that Allah said, surely I am with you if you keep up prayer and pay the poor rate and believe in my messenger and assist them and offer to Allah a goodly loan. I will most certainly cover your evil deeds. So, what they were appointed for was to encourage good deeds among the people. What the Prophet had taught them, to encourage people to practice it. So that when Prophet arrives in Medina, in a way everyone knows what's the message of this Prophet, what they should do, except questions that of course came up later on when Prophet went to Medina and all these surahs and ayat revealed about those questions of the people of Medina. So, very interesting, the Quraysh, God knows by whom, were informed of this secret meeting. Of course, the meeting was completely secret. No one knew about this meeting except these 75, who actually had already arranged everything way back from Medina. and except the Prophet Ali and Hamza, who went together. Again, of course, you have in books of history that Prophet went with Abbas, his uncle. Very funny. But the Prophet was with Hamza and Ali, peace be on them, and these 75 men. Now, no one knew about it. Who informed people of Medina, people of Mecca? Maybe just suspicious movement of people during the night raised some questions, and people informed that there are things going here very dodgy. And after the meeting finished, they came. And they found Hamza and Ali going back from Aqaba. And they asked Hamza, who's here? What's happening? Hamza said, no one is here. Well, there was no one here, actually, because they had all left. And they said, no, we have to go and see. Hamza took his sword and said, you just pass Aqaba, I'll kill all of you. Because that was their place, actually. It was the house of Abdul Muttalib. So they went back. They went back to the people of Medina. And they were sleeping. They woke them up and said, they said, did you go to make a pledge with the Prophet? Although there were many other Muslims among them, but they didn't know about this because these were elect Muslims of Medina. Now, they said, no, we don't know anything about it. No one knew anything about it. And then they went to Abdullah ibn Ubay, who was the leader of Medina. The Munafiq-to-be, of course, the head of Munafiqin-to-be later on in Medina. And they asked him, what was going on between your people and the Prophet and Muhammad? He said, nothing. If there was anything, I should have known about it, certainly. So they were somehow reassured that nothing went on, and that's how actually things were managed in top secret way. However, they found out later on. They found out when the caravan of Medina left Mecca, and they followed them. Because, as I said, it was very, very dangerous. If such a pledge was made between the people of Medina and the Prophet, then they had lost their route to Syria. They had found a big enemy in their northern quarters. And they had to accept that this man whom they despised, the radical, now has become the leader of another city, a very important, major city. So they didn't want to let this to happen. So they followed them, but they couldn't get anyone except Sa'd ibn Ubadah. Poor Sa'd ibn Ubadah, I really feel sorry for him all the time, because this was the man who disagreed with the agreement in Saqifa, and probably the only man who was killed because of the incident. Of course, he was the head of Khadraj, very prominent person, but since he disagreed with the bay'ah to Abu Bakr, he was killed in the middle of the night. And then, of course, no one knew that who killed Sa'd ibn Ubadah. They killed him, they shot him an arrow. And then they spread a rumor that when Sa'd ibn Ubadah was killed, the jinn were singing a poem. And that poem was that قَدْ قَتَلْنَا سيد الخزرج سعد بن عباده ورميناه بسحمين ولم نخف فؤاده. We, the jinn, we killed سعد بن عباده, the head of Khazraj. We hit him with two arrows in his heart and we did not miss it. But of course, very funny rumor that. And then people started to say, yeah, it's possible because he was alone in the desert during the night, so it's possible that jinn had hit him with some arrows. Now, here as well, this poor man was the only man who the Quraysh could put hand on and bring back to Mecca, asking him what did happen. And of course, he was one of those people who was present in this bay'ah of Aqaba. So, of course, he didn't say anything, but they arrested him, they brought him back, and he said, everyone seeing me started to beat me, to slap me, and the man almost actually was dead. And then someone who he had given protection in Medina once, saw him and said, leave this man, this is under my protection. And in this way, he was saved. So this mutual type of protection giving to each other saved him. Now, in Medina, the da'wah becomes more rigorous. Now, up till now, it was just a type of words going around. Now the youngsters in Medina become a bit offensive. Who? Sa'd ibn Ubadah. No. He was killed after Saqifa. He was the head of Khazraj. He was killed after Saqifa because he did not give bay'ah to Abu Bakr, and he was very staunch about it, so he was killed after that. Now, the youngsters in Medina, of course, you know, the youngsters are always revolutionary and extremists. They want to do things very quickly. So they started to destroy idols of those people who still had not converted to Islam. One of these very, very interesting stories, which has become very famous and reported in all books of history, is the story of the idol of Amr ibn Jamuh. This Amr ibn Jamuh, of course, when he converted to Islam, he became a very, very prominent person, outstanding in Islam. Now, he had an idol who worshipped very sincerely and in a very dedicated way. Every morning he cleaned the idol, put jewelry on the idol, and perfumed and these things. Now, these youngsters of Medina who had converted to Islam, who were from the same tribe, the same family, of course. Of course, people of other tribes or families, they didn't dare to do such a thing. Same family. They came one night, they took the idol and threw it in a place where rubbish were being dumped. Now, in the morning, Amr saw that, oh, his idol is not there. He went and looked it and found it in that rubbish dump. He brought it, washed it, put the ornaments on him and said, "I swear by your honor that if I knew who has done this to you, I would have killed him." Okay. The next day they did the same thing. And this happened several days. And he really became angry. He was frustrated. He didn't know who is doing this and why this is happening. So one night he put a sword on the idol. Idol's shoulder, and he said, "You know, you protect yourself. I'm tired of protecting you all the time. You protect yourself tonight, and anyone coming, you kill him." Well, of course, these youngsters knew what was going on in the house. So on that very night, they took the idol, they tied a dead dog to him, to it, and just dumped it in that rubbish. And next morning, Amr ibn Jamuh went and saw what has happened. So he suddenly was awakened. He said, "If you were a god, you would have been able, if you were a god, you would have been able to protect yourself." And then he rebuked himself, "Why I was worshipping you all these times?" And there's a very nice poetry that he actually sang on that day, on the event of seeing that idol, and said that, "What type of god you are that now you are tied with a dead dog and you cannot protect yourself?" And he converted to Islam. The youngsters, of course, were successful. And this was something, this is a generic type of event which was going on in Medina. And all these were before Prophet migrated to Medina. Yes.
This story, did the youngsters make it up themselves, or did they look at the story of Ibrahim and copy that? Did they hear the story from the Prophet?
No, of course, Ibrahim did it very bravely. They did it in hiding, no one knowing about it. No, of course, like, it's a very different story.
I mean, they may have heard from the Prophet. I don't know if this ayat was revealed or this surah was revealed. The Prophet may have told them the story of Ibrahim. And they said, "That's a good idea, we should try it." I don't know.
Maybe, but they didn't try it like that, going in front of Amr ibn Jamuh and breaking the idol. This is what Ibrahim did, wasn't it? But, of course, they did it in a very very prudent way, so to speak. I don't want to say that Ibrahim was not prudent, but that was the way that he had to face the challenge. Now, the threat is sensed very, very vigorously by Meccans. They cannot, of course, put up with this situation anymore. They cannot stop people migrating to Medina. Whatever they do, they just flee Mecca and go. So they started to use new measures and tactics. One measure was Okay, anyone wants to go to Medina goes. But they shouldn't look back to anything they leave behind in Mecca. So they started to confiscate the property of any person who left for Medina. Of course, those people who left for Medina, they didn't think that they are going to leave Mecca forever. They thought that one day we are going to come back. For example, if you are in need, we have a house here, we have a piece of land here, we can sell it later on. So they looked after their property or they trusted it with someone and left. Now, what Abu Sufyan decided was that, okay, now what we do, anyone going to Medina, we confiscate their property. A couple of instances, very famous. One is the story of Suhaib. Suhaib was a Roman man who was enslaved and then freed by Abdullah ibn Jad'an. And he was a very good businessman. Of course, when he was leaving Mecca for Medina, migrating, he had lots of wealth with him that he actually carried with him. Lots of gold and other things and he carried to, was carrying it to Medina. Now, they came to him and said, we do not stop you going to Medina. Of course, they thought that this man is someone who just stays with what he has, his property. We don't mind you going to Medina, but you cannot take the money because this is the money earned in Mecca. It should be spent in Mecca. And we don't allow you to take it. He said, okay, take it and spend it in Mecca. I just leave everything behind and go. And of course, Suhaib is an exemplar of dedication because in Medina, he was just like a beggar, a poor man. You can imagine someone with that amount of wealth now in Medina becomes one of Ashab al-Suffa, just sleeping on the benches around the most of the prophets. Another example was Banu Jahsh, from whom are, of course, Abdullah ibn Jahsh or Zainab bint Jahsh, who later on became wife of the prophet. Now, this Banu Jahsh had lots of estates around Medina and around Mecca and houses in Mecca as well. So when they went, they trusted everything to people and they said, okay, one day we will come back or we'll tell you what to do with them. But when they were going, of course, because they were a group of people of Mecca couldn't stop them. They went to Medina. However, the news arrived that Abu Sufyan has confiscated whatever you had and has sold it, actually, and taken the money for himself. Of course, Abu Sufyan didn't need that money at all. And certainly, because of that, moreover, he was not that mean to take money of a property sold in that way, confiscated and sold in that way. But they just wanted to teach a lesson to people of Medina, that those who migrate to Medina, this is the fate of them. And so it happened, of course, for anyone who had anything in Mecca. Of course, it could not stop Muslims migrating to Medina. Now, the other thing was, before Prophet migrates to Medina, now the danger was very imminent. Before Prophet migrates to Medina, we have to do something. Because if this man goes, skips out of our hands, that is a big problem for us. So they decided, despite all problems and difficulties that would have created, they decided to kill the Prophet. Now, of course, there was a shura, a council. They arranged a council in Dar al-Nadwa. You remember when we talked about Qusay ibn Kalab, we said he established an institution in Mecca called Dar al-Nadwa, in which the elders of the community, they came together. When something very important happened, they came together, they consulted about it. Now, here, 40 men, and Dar al-Nadwa had a very stringent rules. For example, no one could ever enter Dar al-Nadwa unless they are 40 and above. 40 years and above. Not youngsters were not allowed in Dar al-Nadwa. And very strict tribal rules as well. So 40 of the heads of Quraysh, they went to Dar al-Nadwa. And they said that, okay, we now have to decide what to do with Muhammad. This is the end of it. This is the end of the story. If we linger about for another month or a few months, then Muhammad is the big enemy in Medina. So we have to do something about it. So, it is mentioned in books of history that an old man from Najd, Najd is the place where the Saudis come, an old man from Najd went to Darul Nadwa, and of course there were guards on the door, and he said, could you ask the council if they allow me to go in and help them with their consultation? They said, who are you? He said, I am an old man from Najd. And he was so nice and looked so wise that persuaded the guards to go in to ask if this man could be permitted in, and they said yes. Now, the books of history and hadith, they say this was Shaitan himself going in the shape of a man to give consultation to the people of Mecca. What to do? Because they had lost their minds. They had lost their senses. They could do very, very nonsensical things out of fear. Fear of Muhammad running out of Mecca, out of their hands. Now, of course, we have, in many instances, we have in traditions that Shaitan appeared in form of a man. For example, in Battle of Badr, Shaitan appeared and told to Mushrikun that go and fight, I am with you. And in other instances. Now, of course, there's this discussion, is it really Shaitan appearing in form of a man? Or is it really a man who is inspired by Shaitan? This second view looks more plausible. Although the first view, an evil man, but especially inspired by Shaitan for this instance. The first view is not totally, I mean, we cannot just without any reason reject the first view because it's mentioned in many of traditions, but it would be very difficult to accept that Shaitan has such an influence, direct influence. Although, well, it's not impossible, but the second view is more plausible, that Shaitan inspires someone to go and do such things. Anyhow, this old man was very wise. Probably wiser than Shaitan himself. So, he went, he was listening. They were discussing, what should we do to Muhammad? Now, one of them, Abu Jahl, this was not the suggestion Abu Jahl, the first suggestion, to imprison him. They said, we imprison him until he dies. We don't kill him so that his blood is on our hands. We imprison him. We don't give him food. He dies. Now, this old man of Najd, he said, then do you think people of Medina would leave you? They come and will fight you. Do you think Banu Hashim would leave you? They fight you to release him. Do you think other Muslims around would leave you? This is not a good idea. Now, Abu Jah said, okay, we appoint a brave man to kill him. And if they want to kill him, we do not allow to kill this murderer. We do not allow, and we pay blood money 10 times. Money was not, of course, important. We sent 10 times blood money to Banu Hashim. Now, the old man of Najd said, well, I'm surprised. You know Banu Hashim. They're not going to accept blood money from you, even if you pay 100 times. Then there is war. Then when there is war, there is trouble, and you are not looking after. Well, because he had a better plan. Of course, it was good to kill Muhammad, peace be on him, but he had a better plan. Now they said, okay, another thing we can do. We deport him. Get rid of him. Not letting him to go to Medina, we deport him somewhere far away. This old man of Najd laughed at them and said, what silly people you are. Because this man that I have seen, anywhere you send him, even to China, he would attack them and come back here to you. And he can put everyone under his spell. So where do you want to deport him? They said, okay, what should we do? Now, this suggestion is actually reported in the Quran. The verse in Surah Anfal, وَإِذْ يَمْكُرُ بِكَ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا لِيُثْبِتُوكَ أَوْ يَقْتُلُوكَ أَوْ يُخْرِجُوكَ وَيَمْكُرُونَ وَيَمْكُرُ اللَّهُ وَاللَّهُ خَيْرُ الْمَاكِرِينَ. When the faithless devise plans against you to confine you, that was the first suggestion, to imprison him, or slay you, the second suggestion, or drive you away, the third suggestion. And they devised plans, and Allah too had arranged a plan, and Allah is the best of planners. Now, they were convinced by this old man of Najd that none of these plans were good. They said, okay, what do you suggest you should do? He said, the best thing is that from every clan or every tribe, one person is chosen. And even from Banu Hashim, one person is chosen, they go together, they kill him together. All simultaneously they kiss him with a knife or sword. And in this way, the blood is spread among tribes. Banu Hashim, first of all, Banu Hashim cannot fight against himself. It is that because you have a man from Banu Hashim, which of course later on it transpired to be Abu Lahab. He accepted the mission to be a part of this matter. And secondly, you are 15 tribes. Banu Hashim cannot fight. So they accept blood money. Then you pay blood money. You pay 3 times. Abu Jah said, no, we pay 10 times. Money is not important for us. We just want to finish. So they decided to kill the Prophet in this way. So that no fights, no war, no battle would take place, and then they give blood money. If they wanted to give 3 times, 300 camels, they gave to Banu Hashim, and that was the end of the story. Now, this ploy was an old trick of the past, actually. Probably Shaitan took it from the Quran, because the Quran mentions that people in the past had actually made such a plot against a prophet. And it's in Surah An-Naml about Prophet Saleh. وَلَقَدْ أَرْسَلْنَا إِلَىٰ ثَمُودَ أَخَاهُمْ صَالِحًا أَنْ اعْبُدُوا اللَّهَ فَإِذَا هُمْ فَرِيقَانِ يَخْتَصِمُونَ. We sent Saleh, the brother of Thamud, to them, and he told them, you have to worship God, and then they became two parties fighting with each other. قَالَ يَا قَوْمِ لِمَا تَسْتَعْجِلُونَ بِالسَّيِّئَةِ قَبْلَ الْحَسَنَةِ لَوْ لَا تَسْتَغْفِرُونَ اللَّهَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تُرْحَمُونَ. He said, my people, why are you rushing towards evil? Why don't you seek forgiveness from God so that God would have mercy upon you? And at the end, وَكَانَ فِي الْمَدِينَةِ تِسْعَةُ رَحْطٍ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْعَرْضِ وَلَا أَصْلَحُ. In that city, there were 9 families. Little bit less than, of course, the families which were living under Quraysh in Mecca, who made mischief in the land and did not act aright. They said, swear to each other, the same pledge that they wanted to, they had in Darul Nadwa with each other. They said, swear to each other by Allah that we will certainly make a sudden attack on him and his family by night. Then we will say to his heirs, we did not witness the destruction of his family, and we are most surely truthful. Because, well, witnessing here means that we did not perpetrate it. Because no one individually perpetrated it. So, إِنَّ اللَّهَ صَادِقُونَ. We are truthful. They cannot do anything with us. And then Allah says here, وَمَكَرُوا مَكْرًا وَمَكَرْنَا مَكْرًا وَهُمْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ. They planned a plot, and we planned a plot. And while they, of course, perceived not, see then how was the end of their plan, that we destroyed them and their people all. Of course, this is a very important lesson to us. Anything evil you plan, you will see the result of it. Well, it's said in many places in the Quran. وَلَا يَهِيقُ الْمَكْرُ السَّيِّئِ إِلَّا بِأَهْلِهِ. The evil plans, the evil conspiracies, would not fall on anyone but those who plan it. This is a very categorical verse of Surah Fatir. وَلَا يَحِيقُ الْمَكْرُ السَّيِّئِ إِلَّا بِأَهْلِهِ. You plan evil, that plan, that evil would fall upon yourself. I remember I read somewhere Allama Tabatabai rahmatullah alayhi was very much opposed by some courses of the clergy who were against philosophy and irfan and such issues, and they were going around talking against him, and someone went to him and said, why don't you defend yourself against all these talks and rumors going against you? He recited this verse. He said, why should I? This is not falling upon me, this falls upon themselves. Istikbaran fil arda wa makru sayya wa la yahiqu al makru sayya illa bi ahli. So if anyone is plotting against you, just sit back and rest. Nothing is going to happen. If, of course, we have good faith in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Even if you don't have good faith. I mean, even if you plot an evil conspiracy against a kafir, that will fall against you. If, of course, that kafir does not deserve that evil conspiracy, then it falls upon yourself. It is a categorical rule. I really believe in it. It's something that has no exception. And you see, for example, nations, they start to wrong other nations, to plunder, to massacre, and then after a few decades, or a few hundred years, you see that something more evil has come upon them. More evil. The only thing is that, the only pity is that our lives are very short. We don't see long. If you see through the history, you see that these things have happened. Well, temporarily the effects happen. Yeah. Well, of course, temporarily, I mean, you can harm other people temporarily, always. I mean, people of Mecca harm Muslims for several years. But what happened to them afterwards? So, anyhow. Just forget about lessons that you can take from this. Which one? This is towards the end of Surah Fatir. I don't remember the number of the verse. Surah Fatir. No, it's not this surah, it's this ayah that I mentioned. لا يحيق المكر السيء إلا بأهله. Of course, this says the same thing, but in a different language. Now, after, of course, they made the plot, Prophet was informed by Jibreel that tonight they are coming to kill you, to carry out a plot that they have made in Darul Nadwa. So, of course, Prophet, who was not, of course, deciding to migrate at that moment, was not prepared for it. But since Allah informed him that this is the plot, if you do not leave, you will be killed, then he had to leave. So, on the very night, he decided to leave Amirul Mu'mineen, you know the story there, in his bed, and he left. Now, there are different stories when he left. Was Abu Bakr with him, or Abu Bakr then went after him, or did he go to Abu Bakr and took him with himself? Anyhow, these are things that I will discuss later. But the important thing was the sacrifice that Amirul Mu'mineen made. Because these people coming to kill someone under a blanket, they don't usually just take the blanket to see who this is. They know this should be Muhammad, of course. No one sleeps in this bed except Muhammad. So they would have killed. It was something that, of course, it was a matter of life and death. Now, Amirul Mu'mineen accepted. And it is said that this verse of the Quran is revealed on this occasion. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِي نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ وَاللَّهُ رَؤُوفٌ بِالْعِبَادِ. And among the people is he who sells his life seeking the pleasure of Allah. And Allah is most kind to his servants. These verses are put in Surah Baqarah. It's a comparison between two types of people. وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. From among the people are those who, when they speak, you are surprised how faithful these people are, how knowledgeable these people are. وَيُشْهِدُ اللَّهَ عَلَىٰ مَا فِي قَلْبِهِ. And they bring testification from Allah that we tell the truth, He knows inside our heart. You see, some people, they speak very nicely sometimes. وَيُشْهِدُ اللَّهُ عَلَى مَا فِي قَلْبِهِ وَهُوَ أَلَدُّ الْخِصَامِ. And they are the most stubborn enemies of you. They talk of faith, they talk of iman, they talk of all these things, and you listen to them, you think really they are very high in faith. As in Surah Munafiqun it says, وَإِنْ يَقُولُوا تَسْمَعْ لِقَوْلِهِمْ. When they speak, you like to listen to them. Because they speak very beautifully. And وَإِذَا تَوَلَّى سَعَى فِي الْأَرْضِ لِيُفْسِدَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. When they are given some authority, they start to make mischief on the earth. They يُهْلِكُ الْحَرْثَ وَالنَّاسِ. They kill the people, they destroy the crops and other things. And then it says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْرِ نَفْسَهُ ابْتِغَاءَ مَرْضَاتِ اللَّهِ. But some people do not talk like that. Even if you ask them to talk, they cannot talk about faith to you, with anyone. Or they don't like to talk about it, but they sell their souls, their lives, for the pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, it's interesting, because this verse was revealed about Amirul Mu'mineen. There was a companion of the Prophet who has reported lots of hadith, and Bukhari and others report hadith from him, unfortunately. Samara ibn Jundab. Now, this Samara is a very famous man. This Samara joined Muawiyah afterwards. Of course, Muawiyah needed as much companion as he could bring together. Of course, not many companions he could bring together. Because companions were a treasure for governors and rulers, because they said, these are companions of the Prophet, they are with us. And it's very interesting, in Safin, I think I mentioned this before, in Safin, Amirul Mu'mineen had 18,000 of companions of the Prophet. And Muawiyah had 20 companions in Israel. So you can see, when you are asked about companions of the Prophet, do not be in defense, saying that, no, we do not like companions of the Prophet. No, there were just a handful of people who we don't like, who were against Amirul Mu'mineen. Otherwise, most of the companions, majority, I think in Safin, 18,000 companions were fighting besides Amirul Mu'mineen, and only 20 companions were in the camp of Muawiyah. Now, this Samara ibn Jundab was one of those who was in the camp of Muawiyah. And Muawiyah said, I give you 100,000 dirham. Not dinar, dirham. Dirham was one tenth of dinar. So that 10,000 dinar. I give you 100,000 dirham and you make a hadith saying that this woman and nas man yashri nafsahu ibtigha'a mardati Allah is about me. He said, okay, I give it to you. He made a hadith. Then he said, I give you another 100,000. And you say the previous verse, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يُعْجِبُكَ قَوْلُهُ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا. And some people are faceless, but they speak nicely. It's about Ali. He said, I don't do it. He said, I gave you 200,000 there, so I don't do it. Because, of course, everyone knew what a dangerous area this was. He said, I give you 300,000, so I don't do it. He said, I give you 400,000, he said, okay, I do it. And he did it. He forged the hadith that this is about Ali and this is about Muawiyah. Well, 500,000 dirham. Not a bad deal, anyhow.
Is there a particular reason why Imam Ali said that? Why didn't he see the end?
The reason was that these men actually wanted to kill the Prophet in the beginning of the night. And they came and they surrounded the house. Now, the houses there at that time was made in a way, first of all, the doors were always open, and people could somehow see inside, if especially they had removed the curtains and something, and they wanted to have the bed on the chest so that the Prophet wouldn't leave. Now, they wanted to attack in the night. Now, this poor Abu Lahab, he said, I don't allow you to do this, because this is the house of Banu Hashim, I'm from Banu Hashim, there are women and children here, I don't allow you to scare women and children of Banu Hashim. So, they said, what should we do? He said, we wait until morning. In the morning, we go and kill the Prophet. During the night, I don't allow them. They said, okay. Now, they were watching, but they didn't realize that Prophet and Ali swapped their place. And actually, Prophet came out of that house, passing from before their eyes, but he was reciting وَجَعَلْنَا مِنْ بَيْنَ أَيْدِيهِمْ سَدًّا وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِمْ سَدًّا فَأَخْشَيْنَاهُمْ وَهُمْ لَا يُبْصِرُونَ. And someone came and said, what type of business we have here? Why are we waiting here? They said, we are just having an eye on Muhammad. He said, Muhammad just left. They just laughed at him. He said, go. Don't talk about this. Because they were seeing the bet. They were actually putting it under inspection. So, in the morning, of course, when they went to kill the Prophet, Ali just took the blanket away and said, what do you want here? And they saw, oh, this is Ali, not the Prophet. So, another task was given to Ali as well. And because Prophet had lots of debts and many trusts of people, he was Muhammadul Amin. Still he was Muhammadul Amin. Even Mushrikun brought their trust to put with, to place with him. So many trusts. So he said to Ali that you stay back in Medina, in Mecca, until you pay all my debts. You want to borrow whatever, you pay all my debts and give all these trusts back to the people. Even if they are mushrik or whatever. Give all these trusts. And this we recite in Dua Nuzbah. وَأَنْتَ تَقْضِي دَيْنِي وَتُنْجِزُ عِدَاتِي. You, after I leave, of course, Mecca, or even after I die, you pay back my debts, you give the trust back, whatever I have promised to people, you fulfill that. This is, of course, about Ali. But, of course, the Prophet did not enter Medina without Ali. We'll mention that later on. Prophet went to Quba, waited there for 3 days until Ali joined him, and then he arrived in Medina, accompanied by Ali, peace be on him. Inshallah, we'll discuss these things next week. Any questions? Yes.
Like we have done just now, and many other times. It's so evident how it grows. Why is it then that we have such difficulty convincing the majority of people? I wouldn't extend this certain to why isn't every Muslim that it's not true? Because there might be confounding factors which need to be addressed.
Yeah.
But the message is extremely clear.
Well, you shouldn't forget about 600 years of the rule of Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas. They made the history the way they wanted. Now, it is very famous. When Muawiyah took power, one of the articles of the treaty between Muawiyah and Hassan, peace be on him, was that you should not swear at Ali or say anything bad about him. And he signed it. Then, of course, he tore the treaty and said, I do whatever I want. Now, one of the things that he did, he gave lots of money to his government that you find people who could forge hadith against Ali. Whoever can do this, give them enough money. And they did forge many, many hadith against Ali. And, for example, Prophet was angry with him. Many, many other things. Why did he say he was Abu Turab? And after some while, he said, now we have enough hadith against Ali. What I want now is that for every fadila, for every merit that is reported for Ali, you make the same hadith about the Khulafa. So lots of hadith was made about Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman, giving all these merits to them as well. In a way, Ali, what he wanted to do, he just wanted to bring Ali down and take others off. And now you find, all these merits are mentioned in the books of Ahlul Sunnah. However, equal merits are mentioned for Abu Bakr, for Umar, for Uthman, and the confusion came from there. It was a big, very great confusion, actually. I mean, people who were not aware of the history, they could confuse things very easily. And then, of course, this very, very important rule that he set down, that do not talk evil of any of the Sahaba, including himself, Muawiyah. And that meant that Sahaba, you cannot discuss about them, anything. And if you cannot discuss, then how could you verify things? You cannot judge anything, you could not verify anything. And he made a type of history there which was a closed history, no one could approach.
You see a parallel of this if you look at the history of the Muslims in Europe and the contribution that Islam has made in terms of science and government. you hardly hear anything.
Yeah, that's right.
It's just like, you know, there's, you know, the screensaver I have here on my computer is Athena, whose canon was taken as the medical text for 600 years.
Yeah.
That's a significant amount of time to have an influence on the whole of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
It's not mentioned anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, cleanliness, hygiene, these people learned it from Muslims. I mean, one of the complaints of Muslims when they came across fighting against crusaders were the bad smell, and that they did not use any hygienic, they didn't have any hygienic understanding. They were always dirty, not cutting their hair, not trimming their nails. And now, of course, everything has become opposite, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yes. On in your notes, you talk about the dawah.
Mm-hmm.
What does the word dawah mean?
Dawah means call. Call. Calling towards Islam. Oh, cool. Yeah. Call towards Islam.
Okay. Shaykh, on page 3, you quote the verse from the Quran, referring to the old man from Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And now, does this verse refer to that particular conversation, or does it refer to a different conversation?
No, it refers to that conversation, but it doesn't say that there was an old man from Najd or anything. Yeah, it specifically talks about what happened in Darul Nadwa. Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So you know the ayah that you quoted from the verse of Qatar, and just check that out, ayah number 43.
Oh, thank you. So verse 35, ayah number 43. Thank you. Okay, وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله وصحبه.